Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today.
How do you know God exists? What reasons do atheists have to doubt God's existence? Can you arrive at certainty? These questions are among the most significant that you can ask. Let's face it, if God exists, there are huge implications for your daily life. But if not, then you can more or less choose your own adventure, making up meaning as you go. My guest today is Andrew Drinkard, the editor and project lead on an interesting book called Debating God's Existence, Believers and Skeptics in Friendly Conversation, published by Erdmans. In the interview that follows, I ask him about his backstory, as well as the story behind the debate this book was based on. We discuss Dan Barker's argument against God based on the problem of evil, as well as Adam Johnson's argument for God based on objective morality. Then we engage a bit with Drinkard's own content in the book regarding divine hiddenness. But before getting to the interview, let me say a couple of words about our guest today. Andrew Drinkard is the director of Inspiring Christianity Ministries at inspiringchristianity.com, which is a blog where he showcases his own research. He holds an MA in theological studies and apologetics from Liberty University and is currently completing an MA in philosophy of religion at Palm Beach Atlantic University. His work has been published in the Journal of Classical Theology, and as I mentioned before, he has a book that has just come out called Debating God's Existence. Here now is episode 660, Debating God's Existence with Andrew Drinkard. Andrew Drinkard, welcome to Restitutio.
Sean, thanks for having me, buddy. How are you?
Doing pretty good. To get us started, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Why are you so passionate about your faith, and what was your spiritual journey to Christianity like?
I grew up in Kansas, and as a kid or a teenager, I really didn't have any interest in God or spiritual things. My parents did take me to church quite often, but it's just something that I just never had an interest in. And it wasn't until after my freshman year of college at the university that I was at where I started to realize that the kind of way that I was living, I guess, felt somewhat superficial or shallow.
Okay.
And I felt like there was more that I could be doing, I guess, somehow change the trajectory that I was on. I just felt like I was stuck, and even though living a college life that you'd think would be fun, it wasn't very fulfilling to me. And so I think the Lord was working in my heart and my mind at that time, drawing me away from that. I left Kansas, went to Florida, attended a Christian college there. And that's kind of where I found my way, I guess, and gave my life to Christ and kind of rededicated my life to the Lord. So that's my spiritual journey in a nutshell there. Yeah.
Okay. So how long ago was that?
That was, 2005. So 2006.
A little while ago.
A little while ago. Yeah.
20 years ago now.
It's hard to, I had to think about that. Wow.
Yeah. That's something. So, since then you have really been pursuing apologetics. What really got you onto apologetics? It seems like such a tough field. It's always changing. Once you've mastered like one area of defending the faith, you know, the atheist has come up with a response, and, you know, then there's a counter argument to the counter argument. Tell us a little bit about your interest there.
After Florida, at undergrad, I moved back to Lawrence, Kansas, and I started sharing my faith with some of the individuals in my workplace, actually. I worked for a financial institution. As I started sharing my faith, inviting people to church, I was met with a lot of pushback by some of my peers and good questions, not in a hostile way, but just they had some really good questions and challenges, and I really didn't know how to answer those. And it kind of got me thinking, why do I believe what I believe, I guess? And I started looking into these things and started finding that there were some really good answers to the questions that they had that I didn't know existed. I didn't know these answers were out there. Yeah, it was through that I kind of discovered apologetics, and I saw that God was doing quite a bit with it as I was using it and talking with people. I think the Lord was using that in their minds and their hearts, and so it allowed the conversation to continue. It didn't just stop at sharing a Bible verse. It was long conversations that got to continue on, and relationships develop, and it was really good. So many people out there have personality types with an analytical mindset that haunts them, so to speak, in a way. That is how I am as well. And so intellectually speaking, there's a lot of people out there that really need certain things to make sense in order to get them to the place that they need to be, so they can finally, you know, say to themselves, okay, I'm a rational person, and this worldview that I'm about to commit myself to seems coherent, because no one wants to commit themselves to an incoherent or nonsensical worldview. And so it appears rational. So now I can choose, basically, I can choose to trust or have good reasons to believe that this is most likely true. And so I think it's important because of that, because of so many people out there with that kind of mindset. Not everyone's like that, obviously, but there's quite a few. They want to make sure that this stuff makes sense before they commit themselves to it. And so I also hear a lot of testimonies like this from former agnostics and atheists.
Yeah.
Some of the ministry that I'm involved in, I've heard several testimonies of people that used to be atheists and non-believers. When they were introduced to the basics of apologetics, which is just giving an answer, reasons for your faith and defending your faith, you know, explaining the Christian worldview. Through that series, the Lord used that in their lives to bring them to Christ. And so it's interesting to see how many people have been impacted by basic apologetics. And even someone like Philip Goff, he's a great example. He is an atheist I reached out to him to write a chapter in this book. And Philip Goff has been on Joe Rogan, BBC News. Highly respected philosopher at Durham University. Extremely bright. One of the world's leading thinkers on what's called panpsychism and some other things. But he started out at teaching as an atheist. And at his class, he taught philosophy of religion. And I think he said it was there that once he started teaching for the arguments against the evidence of God, that he basically was like, yeah, this is a done deal. I mean, this is why I don't believe I don't believe in this stuff. But then when it came time to start teaching on the evidence or the arguments for the existence of God, that's when he said it started to move him. During the course of this book, even though he's writing as an atheist, he converted to what he calls a mildly heretical form of Christianity, but still Christianity.
Wow.
Nonetheless, he didn't pick Buddhism or Islam or Hinduism. He picked Christianity because he thinks it's the most coherent view. And that was largely in part due to philosophy of religion, which is, you know, a fancy way of doing apologetics, I feel like, at times.
Yeah. It seems like he's got a chapter in here, non-theist responding to the debate, God or the multiverse.
Yeah. So he, after he told me that he became a believer during the course of this book, he's like, I don't think I can write this. And I said, well, how about you just do it from a non-theistic perspective, you know, the way that you're going to originally write it. And he agreed to that. Yeah. So even though he's a theist, he's writing from a non-theist perspective. So just another case in point of the power of what thinking can do in the Christian worldview and analyzing some of the stuff.
Seems like you're into apologetics because of evangelism. Sometimes people say apologetics is no good for evangelism. All that apologetics is good for is helping people to not get deconverted, right? But I agree with you. I think it's very helpful for evangelism. So many people have not thought through their worldview. They have not thought through the question of origins or morality or any of the other big questions that come up in this whole subject. So I totally agree with you. Now, your new book, Debating God's Existence, centers on a debate that occurred back in 2022 in Orlando between atheist Dan Barker and Christian Adam Johnson. Were you at the debate? And if you were, tell us about it.
I was, yeah. So I met Adam a year prior to this debate at the annual Evangelical Philosophical Society meeting. And I actually recognized him from a YouTube video I watched, because I I'm a nerd and I like to watch debates and YouTube videos like that and discussions on the existence of God while I'm, you know, working out or whatever. I recognize him from a debate that he did. He hosted between a philosopher named William Lane Craig and another moral philosopher named Eric Weilenberg at NC State. And I said, when I saw him at this conference, I said, "Hey man, you did a good job hosting that debate and moderating it." And so just after that, we struck up conversation. We kept running into each other at this conference. And he told me that he was invited down to Florida in Orlando to this annual atheist conference. And he was going to be having a debate on the existence of God. And I said, "Oh, that's awesome." I said, "Well, if you ever need any help preparing or if you need anything, let me know." Basically, he contacted me out of the blue a few months later and said, "Hey, I want to take you up on that if you're still willing to help." And I said, "Sure." So I helped him prepare for the debate. He asked for me to travel down there with him, and I did. Yeah, kind of the rest is history.
So you were a total insider from the beginning with this whole thing.
Yeah. So it was me and him down there, exactly. So I went from A to Z, basically.
Yeah, yep. Awesome. Dan Barker is pretty famous. I've certainly watched some of his stuff in the past, and I'm not really big in the apologetic space. I'm primarily just a pastor, and so I care about apologetics as it relates to working with people who have doubts that come up. And so I have a very sort of limited, pragmatic approach to the subject of apologetics. But even I've heard of Dan Barker. You know, he's he's kind of a big name in that arena. And so in the debate, what would you say was the strongest argument that you thought was just like really needed to be responded to?
Yeah, he brought up the problem of evil in a way that appeals more to the emotions of people.
Yeah.
He does a good job, I think, rhetorically speaking. And so when you start working on the emotional aspect of the problem of evil, not really the rational or the logical problem or the evidential problem, then basically you can really get people to be persuaded by what you have to say there. So I think he did a good job of bringing up just different problems that we see, you know, out there as far as, you know, kids with cancer and, you know, some moral evil, stuff like why do people hurt other people, natural evil, earthquakes, hurricanes, you know. So, but that's been the toughest thing that Christians have, I think, had to deal with since the beginning of doing this stuff, of thinking about their faith. And the problem of evil is probably without a doubt the most difficult thing to wrestle with as a Christian. So I think that's where he did the best at presenting his case.
Well, just in case anybody out there watching this is not familiar, run us through what the problem of evil is and like how atheists use that to argue against Christianity or theism, I suppose.
Yeah. So the problem of evil basically says that, you know, if God is all loving and he's all good, then why are we seeing so much evil and hurt in the world? Right? If he's all good and he's all powerful, then surely he'd have the strength to stop it. So if he's not stopping it, then maybe he's either too weak and he's not all powerful, or maybe he's not very good himself because he's choosing not to prevent the stuff that he could prevent. And so it's that kind of trilemma. Atheists want to say there's so much evil and suffering in the world that if there is a really a good, loving God out there, then he would prevent all this bad stuff from happening.
Yeah.
That's kind of the problem of evil.
And Dan Barker is a former preacher, right?
He is.
So,
pastor.
And,
yep.
And whether he's a Christian or not, he's still a preacher.
Right. That's a good point. That's
When I see him defending, you know, talking about this problem of evil and other stuff, you know, he uses the Bible and he, you know, he uses emotion like a preacher would. And it is pretty powerful. What would you say is like the most convincing rebuttal to the problem of evil from a Christian point of view?
There's a few different ways that you could take that. One is what they call like the no-see-um objection. Basically, if you don't see it, you know, you don't see any reasons for why God is allowing this stuff to happen, doesn't mean that there's not good reasons. So basically, it's we're in as this finite creatures, you know, there's this infinite being out there, or this maximally great being who knows all things, right, and has a plan and purpose for some of the stuff that's happening. And so we're basically not in the right state of mind or intellectual capacity or the right position to know if there's good reasons for allowing certain evils to occur. We can trust God and his character that even though some terrible stuff happens along the way, it's not for just nothing, and that God can bring a lot of good out of that evil and that stuff. So that's one way of looking at it. And so kind of another way is that some of this stuff that we see out there, you know, the things that we see God uses in our lives to make us stronger, right? I mean, if you work out, you look like a guy that works out, you know that if you lift weights and you start building muscle, that's not a pleasant experience, but yeah, it benefits and yields great results. And so you can't have strength if you don't have weakness. You can't have courage if you don't have fear. So a lot of these things, what some people call a soul building theodicy, or basically a way to explain of your moral development, your character, you become a much better person through trials and circumstances, various circumstances, rather than just having a button that you could push to get out of any trouble at any time, yeah, right? You'd probably become pretty spoiled, pretty weak. And so the Lord can use these difficulties in your life to point you to him. Mm-hmm. And so I think C.S. Lewis said, God speaks to us in our conscience, whispers in our pleasures, and okay, shouts in our pain. It's his, yeah, megaphone to rouse a deaf or a dying world. So, yeah, and I think that's right. I think sometimes when you're on your back, the only way you have to look is up. And a lot of people, if you ask them their testimonies of how they are a great person or how they're so resilient, they've went through hardships and trials, mm-hmm, and it made them better, and they found, you know, Christ through that. So those are a couple of the options that you can give people that, yeah, but it's, again, it's hard because you're doing it from more of a rational, logical side. And that's not what people are looking for when they're going through distress. They need more of a pastoral, right, an emotional, they need an emotional answer and not always a rational one. So problem of evil is is a touchy, tough one to deal with, yeah, when you're talking with people. So it makes sense on paper. It makes sense when it's logically structured out and it's not incoherent. And it does, we do see that a good God could still exist, but we just are, as people and fallen creatures in this world affected by sin and pain, it's still not easy to answer. And when you deal with it, the emotional aspect of it, it's very challenging.
Yeah. I appreciate your two-pronged answer here, because typically the sort of people that go for answer number one you just gave, which is God has his reasons and we don't have access to them, are the very people that don't go with option number two, which is there are some goods that can't exist without the kind of world that also allows for suffering, even gratuitous suffering.
Right.
And those people in that second category usually don't accept that first one. So I think, you know, those are really two interesting answers. As far as Adam Johnson in the debate back in 22, what do you think were his strongest arguments for God's existence?
Well, Adam's a moral philosopher. He did his PhD in philosophy, religion, and concentration in moral theory and ethics and stuff. So I think he did the best in presenting the moral argument for God's existence and basically showing that if God exists, or why do we see these things that seem to be good, and why do we see things that seem to be evil, like objectively speaking, like true, independent of whatever you and I think, like, you know, truth is exclusive by definition, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, regardless of how you feel about it.
Yep.
And so that's kind of how we see things about like goods and certain evils in this world. And so he's saying that the best explanation for that is most likely that there's a God who is goodness himself, and his nature is the very good, the standard that we look to. And so I think he did a good job explaining the objective moral values that we see out there, goods and evils, and then some of the duties involved with that as well. Why do we feel an impulse to help someone, even if it means, you know, risking our own lives in the process?
So the moral argument points out that if there are objective morals, then there must be some sort of lawmaker or standard by which you can judge them. Could you run us through just like a simple version, yeah, that Adam
would yeah use? So yeah, basically objective moral values exist. God is the best explanation of objective values, moral, objective moral values. Therefore, God probably exists. That's basically how it goes.
Yeah.
It's not deductive. It's abductive. So it's more of an inference, the best explanation, or looking at things, explaining this using what information we have and the likelihood that God exists. So it's based on that.
Now, lots of debates happen. Why do you think this one needed to become a book?
Right. That's a good question. Well, I felt like there could be something fresh put out there. And I felt like this was unique in the sense that, you know, it was at an atheist conference, and usually debates being held about the existence of God are typically at churches or things of that nature. They're usually not at, from what I've seen, at atheist conferences. We just thought it would help bring skeptics and believers together for a respectful dialogue. So even though there's a lot of debates out there, I feel like, that are happening, there actually aren't a ton of debate books. And so we just thought this had a unique story. This actually had developed, this debate started because the annual atheist conference was going to happen regardless, but the person that's in charge of it down there met a pastor in the area in Florida. And through that friendship, they said, hey, you know, we should have this debate. And so it actually happened through, it stemmed through a mutual respectful relationship. And we thought that was kind of unique as well. So,
yeah. Now in the book, it's more than just a transcript of the debate. There's all kinds of other content in here. Tell us about the overall project and why you invited others into it as well, beyond the two debaters.
I wanted to get opinions of some of the world's leading experts in these areas, and also influencers. You know, so I wanted to get these guys and girls to give us a deeper glimpse into what was being discussed in the debate. So I felt like it was unique in that sense, as well as having not only these academics and these professors and people, some of these world leading experts like Robin Collins on the fine tuning argument, Dave Baggett on the moral argument, but you also have influencers, right? People that do this that are not professional academics, but are very intelligent and have large followings. I think Joe Folley from Unsolicited Advice has like a couple million subscribers. Oh, wow. Or something like that. So getting these people's opinions and what they think about this stuff, I think it was interesting. I don't think there hasn't been a book like that as well, where you have both professional academics and then a couple of non-academics discussing the topic. So that's why I wanted to invite the people that I did. So,
yeah, very cool. Let's talk about your chapter on divine hiddenness. And just to start off, what is hiddenness? Why do you think it's so important to tackle this subject?
Divine hiddenness is basically, it looks at the problem of why don't more people believe in the existence of God, right? I mean, where's he at? You know, why are we even having a debate at all? If God exists, why doesn't he just show up, present himself, debate's over? So it's a problem that we all face. It's something that not only non-believers face, but in a way there's a kind of hiddenness that, you know, Christians face. And we see in Psalms and other parts of the Bible where, you know, people are crying out, God, where are you? Why are you hiding your face from me? Where are you at in my calamity and my troubles? There's that aspect of hiddenness, but then there's another aspect of hiddenness where you have non-believers that are not resistant to the idea of God, and they're just flat out don't believe. And they're like, hey, well, where's this loving God at? I mean, at least let him show up so I can actually believe in him, right? You got to at least start believing before you can have a relationship with somebody, is what they say. And so that's the hiddenness argument in a nutshell.
Okay. And so how do you respond?
From the literature that I'm seeing, I like to categorize it basically that there's a major, what I call in the book, major resistors, there's minor resistors, and then there's non-resistant people. So you have these non-believers that some of them are majorly resistant, and they will even tell you that, you know, if God did show up, they want to believe, but they also will say, on the other hand, that if God did show up or if something showed up, they'd say, well, I probably was hallucinating. So they wouldn't believe anyways. right? So they would say, well, maybe I'm being tricked. Maybe someone like David Copperfield's doing a trick. And there's been atheists that have said that. Then you have what I call minor resistors. And these are people that think that they would enter a relationship with God had God revealed himself to them. And they think, yeah, I'm open. I want to believe. I'm ready to accept you, God. But really, internally, they're not ready. And they're just not aware of their own psychology to know this, just like we are. A lot of times we think a certain thing and then we're faced with a circumstance and then we change our minds.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people wouldn't be willing to enter into a relationship with God being these minor resistors, even though they say they would. When push comes to shove, they wouldn't, kind of like a marriage. They wouldn't want to be committed to God for that long. And I call this an optimal relationship. Like God wants an optimized relationship with us, which one is meant for eternity. A lot of people, I feel like, don't want to be with God for eternity. They don't want to be with God, I feel like, even now, let alone for the rest of all of time. And so then you have the non-resistors out there that don't believe, and they're not resisting. That's why they're called non-resistors. And so I say, well, I don't even know if such a person exists, if there's anyone truly not resisting out there. I personally think that everyone's probably a minor resistor to an extent, if not a major resistor. But for those that swear up and down, you know, I'm not resisting, I would enter a relationship, you know, if those people do exist, then why isn't God revealing himself to them? And I say, well, they're temporarily non-resistant non-believers, whereas God's going to wait for the right time to reveal himself to them so they can enter into belief and a relationship with him. So I don't know why exactly the time it takes for those to enter it and why he reveals himself the way he does at those times, but it's just temporarily they're non-resistant, and God's going to use this in their life to draw them into a relationship just later on.
That's a helpful distinction. What do you think about Alex O'Connor and his work? How would you reply to his take on this subject?
So, and the longer I think about, you know, thinking about this more, I've come to realize that, you know, I just don't know. And for those who aren't aware, Alex O'Connor, very well-known atheist YouTuber, has several million subscribers. He actually endorsed the book, but he is one that says he's a non-resistant non-believer. I mean, when you talk with these people, it's not like you're in their heads, and it's not, and you're not them. And obviously, and so it's really hard to know what these people are really going through and what they really mean, what they believe, what they think they believe. Mm-hmm. And so again, we're so unaware of our own psychology and what we would do in certain situations. As I explained in the book, I think Alex would classify to me as a minor resistor, that even though he thinks he's not resisting God, I think there's a portion of him that is or would, if God did reveal himself to him, or just maybe a non-resistor, if, like I said, there is such a thing, which I don't think there is, someone that will eventually believe, you know, at the right time. So,
yeah.
But it's so hard. It's so hard to know that these, you know, because that person, you know, we're not them. So we can't experience what they're going through. So it's hard to say.
Yeah. If you were to have a conversation with Alex, what evidence would you bring? Like, would you say, well, I prayed a prayer and God answered my prayer, but like, he could just say, well, that's just coincidence. I mean, like, what could you bring to show that you have experienced God?
You know, it's almost like Alvin Plantinga, a famous philosopher. He's well known for his reformed epistemology and some things about properly basic beliefs and being justified in what you believe. And there's certain people that, if they're so set in their mind that they don't believe, that no matter what evidence you present to them, it's not going to maybe be enough. And so, but a court of law, like if you're guilty, if you're not guilty, but all the evidence looks like it's pointing to you that you did some crime, but even though you know that you're innocent, it's kind of like that. Like, you know that you've had a transformative experience, that you've experienced God, and you have this properly basic belief that you know that you've that you've experienced God. And even though you can't necessarily prove it or explain it to someone else, you're still justified in that belief that you've had that encounter. Really, it's going to have to come down, I think, to that, because anything you point to, if someone's not willing or wanting to believe, they can just push it aside and point to something else and say, well, yeah, you only did this because of maybe your psychological state, or, you know, you only had this moral development character because of this, or, you know, you look at other religions, they did the same thing. So it's really hard when it comes to someone like Alex or other people that are really, and I don't even know about Alex, but just people that are really against believing and have had a lot of evidence presented to them. But, you know, there's also tons of atheists and agnostics, you know, out there, former ones that are now Christians that are saying the same thing and ended up accepting Christ because of the evidence presented to them.
Yeah.
So it's really tough. It's really hard to say what could convince someone unless God's going to actually do it in their life with certain people. You know, with the mindset that they have, it just might take a big kind of Apostle Paul type experience.
Which happened from time to time. I mean, there's lots of people that testify that.
Right. Yeah. And I tell people, you don't need to have an Apostle Paul like experience. You can just have, as long as you think that, you know, the likelihood is greater than not that, that God exists, that's enough to afford belief. You don't have to have this 100%. You know, absolute certainty, and you're just blown away spiritual experience. You know, for a lot of people, it's a gentle nudging, you know, that God's working in their lives.
Yeah.
And it's kind of subtle, you know, it's not a big getting hit with a bright light. And so I think just a lot of people are so distracted in this life with so many other things going on, you know, whether it's hobbies or extracurricular activities, whatever it is, we're so distracted that we're not paying attention to the nudging that's happening with God every day and his goodness.
Yeah. When you were talking about Alvin planting I was reminded of something a friend of mine, Josh Anderson, said, which he may have stolen from planting, I don't know, but it's the funny scenario where Neil Armstrong goes to a moon denier conference where they're saying nobody's ever been to the moon, and here's Neil, who was the first man on the moon, right? You know, he sits through the conference and he listens to everything, and he's like, wow, these are really great points you guys bring up, you know, like the photograph of the flag, you know, the shadows are weird, or you know, all the different evidence they present. And he's really not even able to offer counter arguments to all of their really interesting lines of thought. But, you know, in the end of the day, he basically just says, well, I know I was on the moon. I might not have responses to all of these really sophisticated arguments, but I still know by personal experience that I did this thing, and that's good enough for me. And if you don't believe it, that's fine. Have you heard that analogy before?
I have not, but that's
a pretty good one, right? Good one.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
I like that one.
That's exactly right.
And on good days, that is good enough for me. On bad days, as a pastor, I deal with people a lot and sometimes walk with them through suffering. And sometimes that suffering is honestly overwhelming. For me personally, being more like you, more analytic in nature, I find the classic apologetic arguments, the sort of like cosmological argument in particular, but fine-tuning, moral argument, William Lane Craig's work on the historicity of the resurrection, we could throw Gary Habermas in there, and you know, that whole crew. That's when those arguments are really that I cling to them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just like just being real vulnerable and honest here, that most days I don't need any of that logic. I don't need the sophisticated, you know, fine-tuning of all the constants, you know, the charge of an electron or the you know, capital G, I think it is the variable to determine a gravitational pull, right? Like all that stuff. I don't think about it that at all. I'm like, I'm just like Neil Armstrong. I'm like, I know God, you know, exists because I've experienced God. He's done this in my life. He's done that in my life. I know these other people. I look at testimonies of people that whose lives have been changed that I know personally and that I've read about that I don't know. And that's fine. But then in the times of darkness, this apologetic stuff is super helpful to me to sort of just like box me in so I don't like let go of the ledge and fall completely into unbelief.
Yeah.
And I just kind of will, in my mind, just run through the more analytic reasons that the apologists have developed over the years. And I find them incredibly helpful personally.
Definitely.
In those times.
Yep.
So
I've heard a lot of people say that as well. A lot of Christians, and the same thing in my experience, you're exactly right. Because the emotions aren't always there, but some of this other stuff that has been developed, it's just, yeah, it's rock solid, and it really does help you in those times of distress. So,
yeah. So tell us about your website, inspiringchristianity.com. What would people find if they go there? Why should they visit?
It's still a work in progress, so to speak. But I did do quite a few articles in there over the years, started several years ago with that. And basically just a little bit more in depth than your average blog. So I created it as more of a tool, a resource for just believers and friends that I know personally that may be struggling with their faith or that want to share something with somebody, because it's a thorough look at the topic without having to buy a book. And
you are an expert, you've been working on this, you've been doing graduate studies, you've been exposed to like the top level reasonings.
I just try to present something that is digestible. I try to put it down on a really lay level way to explain it, but it's something that will still take you some time to work through, but it saves you from going through a bunch of books.
Yeah, that's the real advantage of it. Very good. Well, anything else you'd like to say about you or the book or other resources?
Well, I do know right now that you can purchase the book through erdmans.com and they're doing a 40% off discount until the end of September.
Nice.
So that's pretty cool. That's the same discount they give me when I purchase it. And so it saves you quite a bit of money, rather than doing Barnes & Noble or Amazon or whatever, because they have it at those places as well, but it's, $38.99 there. So you can also watch the debate. It was filmed on YouTube, and you can find that at Convincing Proof YouTube channel. That's Adam Johnson's ministry. It's called Convincing Proof. So if you want to watch the debate that happened there that this book is based on, you can go and check that out on YouTube.
Very good. So once again, the book is called Debating God's Existence, edited by Andrew Drinkard. Thanks so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me, buddy.
Well, that brings this interview to an end. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 660, Debating God's Existence with Andrew Drinkard, and leave your comments, questions, and feedback there. On episode 655, God spoke to himself in Genesis 1:26 with Sam Mansfield. David Tench wrote in saying, great explanation. I suppose I could feel better about talking to myself now. I mean, hey, if it's good enough for God, and of course he's referring to the famous verse where it says, let us make man in our image. And Sam Mansfield was exploring that. He also wrote in on episode 567, Are the Dead Conscious?, which was the interview I did with Dustin Smith and Sam Tiedemann. And he writes the following, the discussion between Tiedemann and Smith is a good one, but a full definition of death and understanding of what death and its intermediate state actually is gets inadequate attention. The passing of animated soul life, that is circulating oxygenated blood, a la Leviticus 17:11, passes in a punctiliar fashion, similar to flicking off a light switch. The body, however, does not instantly become a pile of dust and ashes. The departure of the body is not punctiliar, but progressive. A sunset cannot be compressed into a single moment because it happens progressively. So Tench is talking about what happens when people die, and Smith was taking the perspective that the dead are unconscious, and Tiedemann was taking the dualist view that the soul survives death and lives on in some fashion. Tench continues, okay, so what about human consciousness? Neurological scientists will be the first to tell you that we, humanity, still do not have a fully comprehensive understanding of exactly what consciousness is, but copious evidence demonstrates that the passing of human consciousness is not, or at least is not always, punctiliar. Human consciousness can linger. There is a time period when human consciousness can still function after breath life ceases, and when people experience this and are revived from it before it finally hits, they consistently speak of a strong sense of timelessness. Called NDEs, near-death experiences, or OBEs, out-of-body experiences, many people, especially strict Christian mortalists, are automatically dismissive of such testimonies. Anyone who has been taught that death means zero consciousness and also knows the story of the Witch of Endor from 1 Samuel 28 can easily assume that the person telling such a story has been demonically deluded. Of course, such a judgment is unnecessarily harsh. Once death is complete, there is no human awareness, just as we read in Ecclesiastes and Psalms. But the full process of death unfolds gradually, and what is described by thousands upon thousands of revived experiencers as a timeless state. The progressive interim between the start of death and its completion point explains much. But typical discussions and debates overlook this important reality by speaking as if there exists only two states, the fully alive and the fully dead. But there is a temporary interim state, and any discussion that ignores this reality is boxed into an oversimplification of the issue. According to 2 Corinthians 12:2, the Apostle Paul had an OBE, that's an out-of-body experience. How long does it take for the process of death to finish? Nobody knows for sure, but my theory holds that once a body has decomposed, no consciousness can exist. The fact that the experience is often called an OBE is possibly quite ironic. Testimonies from antiquity often depict the dead as being alive after death because persons revived from an NDE were simply doing the best they could with their limited knowledge base and vocabulary. Most moderns also face difficulties explaining their experiences in terms that people can grasp without distortions automatically taking over. This topic discussed in greater detail in my book, Heaven, Every Use and Usage in the Bible. Well, thank you, David Tench, for writing in such a thorough and interesting comment. I totally agree with you that there is this liminal state on the threshold of life and death when all this weird stuff is happening that people report about. And when they are revived and brought back to full consciousness, they do have these reports that I think are mounting evidence that something is going on here. And it's not just a lack of oxygen. Some of the reports are quite impressive. But at the same time, I am bound by Scripture to agree with the clear statements that the dead are asleep, or that there's no thinking in the grave where you're going, or work, and so forth, that we find in Psalms and Ecclesiastes that you mentioned. So I want to marry these together. I want to say, well, just like a computer that is going into hibernation mode, loads all of its data from its CPU and basically short-term memory onto the hard drive so that it can be revived, and that is a transition process. Going into, if you've ever seen an older computer in particular do this, like it actually has a little progress bar that is filling from left to right as it literally just prepares to go into power off mode, where it's not using power and it's put things in long-term storage. And then when you press the power, it has to reanimate, it has to reload all of that data into the CPU, which would be like the brain of the human, and get everything back to where it needs to be so that, boom, it picks up right where you left off. So I don't know. I find that to be a pretty helpful analogy. What do you think? Come on over to restitutio.org, find episode 567, Are the Dead Conscious? And leave your thoughts and feedback there. Well, that's going to be it, everybody, for this week. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you'd like to support us, please share this episode with your friends. Let them know about the show. And if you'd like to support us financially, that would be great too. You can do that at our website, restitutio.org. I'll catch you next week. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.